Welcome in to the David L. Gray Show, off code and unscripted on St. Dominic's Media. It is about 8 p.m. here in Germany, and we are streaming live on Facebook, YouTube, and X.com. We also have the audio version. If you're listening on Spotify or iTunes, please leave me that 5-star review. It definitely helps with the algorithm. But however you're listening, wherever you're listening, whenever you're listening, welcome in. Just glad that you're here. Glad that you are here for this awesome show. How many things do I have for you today? Me just has one thing for you today, man. Just one thing. But it's going to be a great show. We have Aaron Sang here from Tradivox. He's the editor, the founder. He does a lot of things with catechisms. Hop over to Tradivox.com. We'll talk a little bit more about that when he comes on. But he is a great guy. Why is he a great guy? Well, the subject that we're talking about, well, he's a great guy for a lot of things, right? But when in this instant case, what we're talking about, he wrote an essay over Crisis Magazine saying that can the Vatican ban the Latin Mass? Aaron says the catechism says no. Well, I say yes. We disagree. So we're going to talk about our disagreements and maybe where we agree. And so I think that's really cool because you guys know sometimes I invite people on a show who I may not agree with about some particular thing that they're talking about. And you know, the last person we talked about this, last person I had come on the show to talk about some sort of disagreement, they called me Stranger Danger, blocked me on Facebook. But Aaron saying he's different. He's an adult. He's a man. You know, he wrote something in public and he says, hey, you know, I can come on your show and we can talk about that. We can disagree, whatever. That's what men do, right? So he's a cool guy. So happy to have him on. So what we're going to do, I'm going to bring him on after the intro. And then we're going to talk a little about catch up a little bit because he's on my old show on Guadalupe Radio Network. He was on there. So we kind of know each other from there. So we're going to catch up a little bit and then we'll get into the content. And then if you have any questions or comments, hop on. I'll make sure I get to them. You know, Christine Harrington, she was on the show yesterday. You know, we were talking about Donald Trump and the whole, you know, pro-life movement that is really not really pro-life anymore, you know. And before the show, I was saying, man, I have such issues. Like, what do I wear on the show? Because I have a lot of clothes, right? But I always don't like what I'm wearing. So Christine was like, just wear black. You like wearing black, don't you? Just wear black. So that's what I'm doing. I'm just gonna wear black. You know, she said Steve Jobs does it, Elon Musk, they just wear black, whatever. So yeah, I'm just gonna wear black. Today I have on this cool hoodie from Saint Odile. We went to my church here in Germany. We went to this parish, this sanctuary called Saint Odile. I had never heard of Saint Odile, right? Phenomenal. I guess that's the coolest thing about living in Europe. You just walk around, you're in the woods, next thing you know, you bump into a saint. And so check out, look up Saint Odile, and you'll be fascinated by her story. I had never heard of this saint. So yeah, I think that's all I have to say about that. Let's get into the show. This is David L. Gray Show, off code, unscripted, on Saint Dominic's Media. Aaron Sang is coming up from Tradivox. Be right back. Hello there. I am David O. Gray, the host of Off Code and Unscripted. I'm also the president and publisher of St. Dominic's Media. At stdominicsmedia.com, I would like you to hop over to our website today and take a look at everything we have to offer you there. And while you're there, I want you to become a member of our family. If you become a member of our family at just for $5 a month, I'm going to send you a gift. I'm going to send you a book of your choice from our collection as just a gift of you becoming a member of our family. And if you become a lifetime member, and I hope you do, you become a lifetime member, I'm going to send you every book we have ever published at St. Dominic's Media and every book we will publish in the future. And just for you helping our apostolate, becoming a member of our family, and just helping us carry out the mission that we have received, and that is to help people live their best liturgical life. So hop on over to St. Dominic's Media and see how much more you like us there. Thank you. Aaron, How's it going, man? Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. Great to be back with you. And when did the Germany relocation happen?
Man, 2022, September. So we're coming up on like 2 years. So we're just here. My wife and I, we work for the Department of Defense. So we're just here, you know, doing the mission, man.
Well, God bless you. You are in mission territory.
Yeah. And I said before you came on, man, you look really good for a guy that's who's van. You had like a Honda Odyssey or something that flipped over, a Honda Pilot. What was it?
I did. I did the barrel roll maneuver in a large minivan. It was really something. Yes. Thanks man. To you and all those who prayed and supported me through that. I'm about done with the rehab and things now, so I'm
okay.
Doing a lot better.
Yeah, you're looking really good. Was it just you in the van?
Yes, thanks be to God. Yeah, it's just me.
Okay. Yeah, man. Yeah, that's good, man. Yeah, we're glad to have you here. We definitely would have missed you because you do awesome work over at Tradivox. That's TRADIVOX.com. Make sure you go over there. Matter of fact, let me pull it up to kind of show people kind of what you do over there and guide us through the website. Where are we looking at here?
Sure. There's not a lot on the site in as much as there's not a lot that Tradivox does except for restore old catechisms. So our general kind of approach, it's been a little over 10 years, but we've only been incorporated nonprofit in the U.S., federal nonprofit since 2019. So, but that work just generally has been looking at the tradition of catechisms within the church. It comes as news to a lot of folks that there are more than a few Catholic catechisms in our heritage there. So, We've gone back, we've really pulled kind of the best of the best from the last 8 centuries, and we're remastering those, kind of republishing those as a cross-indexed hardback series. So I've got it here. Those that are watching there can see some of them over my shoulder here. So it's going to be a 20-volume series. It comprises over 30 different catechisms from, I mean, we're going, you know, as early as the 1200s, late as the 1950s, and really everywhere in between. So being able to see your Catholic doctrine and this continuity across time and space is really remarkable. And that's really the nature of our project.
And I was reading your essay, the one that's in question today. You had brought up some catechisms that I was unaware of, which, you know, doesn't surprise me at all, because people would just write catechisms, whether they were religious figures or, you know, theologians, they would write catechisms and publish them, you know, as teaching documents, as teaching books. And so you had mentioned a couple, like, hey, I guess a lot of people are familiar with the popular ones, like the catechism that we, the mainstream catechism that we have today, the Catechism of Trent, people are familiar with, but there are just people were just writing catechisms, right?
That's right. Yes, we have thousands of catechisms in the tradition. So it's tough to, I always chuckle. People ask about, have you looked that up in the catechism? You know, because the Catholic answer is always, well, which one? Like, which one do you mean?
Which one? Yeah.
Especially for bishops, it was common practice, particularly up prior to the Second Vatican Council. You had a little more of individual bishops doing this. This was
And you had like the Baltimore Catechism, which was one that more like a council of bishops would have put together, right? Yeah.
And that became kind of more the norm following the council. Obviously, there's been, I mean, there are hundreds of catechisms that have been published since the council as well, all over the world. But most of those haven't entered, you know, the public mind as much as some of those published by, of course, the 92 or the catechism formerly known as the 92 catechism, John Paul II, the CCC catechism of the Catholic Church. That one's top of mind for a lot of folks. You mentioned the Baltimore, that's a synod of bishops. There's been several like that issued by local or regional synods. Especially prior to the 20th century, you had individual bishops using it was a function of the ordinary magisterium for them. Within the diocese, they would issue their own catechism. So that's pretty common.
Yeah. And so you have that apostolate, but also you do writing. I know you write at Crisis Magazine. That's the one of the essays we're going to look at today. You write at 1 Peter 5. What other, what do you generally write about?
Mostly about catechisms. I'm a fairly one.
Really? I would never have thought that would have been what you would write about. That's amazing.
No, it's true.
You caught me by surprise.
Yeah, what I've found in doing the work with Chatterbox, again, it's been, you know, more than 10 years on the research side, and with, we're a networked, international network of scholars, editors, researchers, and so on. And as we kind of undertook this work over the years, we just found, first of all, that we thought the traditional, classical, you know, fill in the blank of your adjective, these older catechisms would mostly just be of interest for scholars. And that was really how we started the project. Okay. We thought, well, this will be great for seminaries, you know, it'll be great for universities and so on. What we found along the way was that there were Catholics all over the world that were just hungry for this content. I mean, we got, you know, Aquinas Catechism, the Robert Bellarmine, the Peter Canisius. I mean, all these heavy hitters that that folks just love or they were interested in. And so as we kind of went further into that, you know, we tried to make the text a little more available to people. We found there were all these kind of misconceptions about what a catechism is, how it functions, you know, the level of authority involved, just all of these kind of nuanced things that really haven't been explored a lot. So most of the time, if I'm ever writing, which I don't do a ton of that out in the Catholic blogosphere, you know, but if I do show up, that's usually what I have to talk about.
Yeah. When you're not doing Catholic stuff, what are you doing?
Well, in the Catholic sphere is most of my work. So I'm also an assist at Sophia Institute Press, is a big Catholic publisher. I help them as well with Benedictus periodical. Some folks are familiar with that. It's kind of a monthly magazine. So I help with that. I pinch hit with cabinetry from time to time. Now, I like a little woodworking. I kind of do any number of things.
That's a good habit. Good hobby. All right, sir. What's without further ado, listen, I'm gonna play one more commercial for St. Dominic's Media, then we'll come back. We'll get into your essay. How's that sound?
Great.
All right, be right back. This is the David O. Gray Show, Off Code, Unscripted. Got Aaron Sang here. We'll be right back. Hey, you guys are going to love this. We completely refurbished our merch store at St. Dominic's Media. So come over to St. Dominic's Media, hop over to merch and see what we have to offer you. We got some new stuff, but we still kept the old classic rigid Catholic. I know you love it. A lot of you guys have it. You send me the pictures. I seen you in person with the rigid Catholic. So it's a classic. It's not going anywhere, but we have it on some new things. We have it on shorts now. You get your rigid Catholic shorts. It's hot outside. Put your shorts on, but let everybody know that you're a rigid Catholic in shorts. Also, this is our new design. Now, you've heard, what would Jesus do? WWJD. But the fact of the matter, there's a lot of things that Jesus would do that you can do. It's like dying for people's sins, right? That's what Jesus would do, but you can't do it. It's already been done. But what would Jesus not do? That's the question. What would Jesus not do? Because everything Jesus would not do, you can't do either. So get the merch. Put it on. Put it on shorts. Put it on a hoodie. Send me a picture when you do it. This is the new merch at St. Dominic's Media. We got more coming, but check out this for now. What would Jesus not do? And rigid Catholic. Take a picture. Send it to me. I want to see it. I want to post it. StDominicsMedia.com. Get the merch. So, Aaron, you wrote this essay over at Crisis Magazine, and it's called, Can the Vatican Ban the Latin Mass? The Catechism Says No. Sub here is a canonical approved catechism supported by many catechisms of the past answers whether the Vatican has the authority to shut down the Latin Mass. And did you write this essay in response to the rumors of what may be happening?
Yes, somebody had sent that across my desk, and I thought, well, it should at least be taken from a catechism perspective. It's probably something that folks wouldn't think to do. So that was what prompted it, yes.
Yeah. And so what's your thesis, basically, in essay?
Sure. Well, my thesis is mostly just an agreement with the Credo Compendium mm-hmm. of the Catholic Church that folks are probably familiar with, but this is the Catechism of Bishop Athanasius Schneider that was released last year. And he just kind of simply frames it because he takes this particular question, several questions in the text that are addressing the point as a whole. It's a Q&A catechism. So for those not familiar with that. So he has several questions devoted to the general topic of the traditional Latin Mass, you know, its role in the church, and then the regards to the magisterial authority involved with it. So he just asks the question directly, can a pope abrogate a liturgical rite of immemorial custom in the church? It's kind of, again, leaning on this canonical language about immemorial custom. And is just his simple answer is no. Just as a pope cannot forbid or abrogate the Apostles' Creed or the Niceno-Constantinopolitan Creed or substitute new formulas for these, neither can he abrogate the traditional millennium-old rites of the Mass and the sacraments or forbid their use as much in Eastern as in Western rites. With the R-I-T-E-S. So that would be the thesis.
Yeah. And why did you find that this is one rub of your essay is just that Archbishop Schneider's credo, obviously in several areas of his book, just says the opposite of what the CCC says, right? Just flatly the opposite on several places. But in your essay, you called it, you know, an authoritative, you said canonically approved. It does have an imprimatur, doesn't have a nil obstat, obviously, but why would you lean into this one so heavily when he does teach the opposite of what the CCC says in several places?
Sure. Well, the first point being the canonical level of any text. I mean, just to say that a catechism is issued authoritatively is just to say that it's been done with the teaching office of the bishop. So the imprimatur obviously is a kind of a stamp indicating that. It's a system that's been in use for a couple of centuries, but only a few. Most catechisms don't have imprimaturs, historically speaking, but they're nonetheless authoritative teaching documents because being issued, you know, by the office of the bishop. And so when a text receives an imprimatur today, that's the concept behind it, is that you have here. In fact, I've even seen, I should have grabbed one, but I've even seen recently texts where the bishops are adding an imprimatur and then a little disclaimer right under it. Maybe you've seen some of these, David, where it'll have right under the imprimatur. The imprimatur is a declaration that this text is free from error in matters of faith or morals, but not necessarily that the bishop granting the imprimatur agrees with all of the contents contained herein, you know, which is kind of a, leaves you scratching your head what that's supposed to be. But, but suffice to say, this is the only catechism to even take up the question of the traditional Mass specifically, right, and the extent of the Pope's authority in regards to liturgical matters in a kind of pointed way, and thus the citing from this text.
Yeah, he deals with that exactly. I mean, catechism was published in 2023, so I mean, I guess the issue was present on the minds of many of the audience of the people who would be attracted to that catechism. So I thought it was interesting when you were going through several different catechisms and you're dealing with the issue of obedience a lot, but then you got to his and he deals with the question itself that you were asking. But when I looked at the subject itself, it seemed to me, and you know, I'll let you get in here and see where you agree and or disagree. So in the history of the Catholic Church, right, there has been two ordinary forms, right? We can say the Mass of 1570, who's that, Pius V. You know, he comes along, his quo prim, he published this, and he says, this is largely, you know, this is the ordinary form of the church. This is our liturgy. Any liturgy that is not older than 200 years has to cease, you know, but he grandfathers some older ones in, right? Some that we still have today. So there's the Ambrosian, you know, Dominican right, and such, so on and so forth. So for until Vatican II, this was the liturgy of the church, the ordinary form. This liturgy was imported, exported, just spread throughout the world. This was the liturgy of the Roman rites, right? That changed, obviously, after Vatican II. Sancto Sanctum Concilium said, hey, we should do something with the liturgy. It delineated what should happen. What should happen did not exactly happen, but we got a new ordinary form, right? So this has been the history of the church. Even though we have many liturgies, these are the two liturgies that were of the church globally that all Catholics worship in. When Pope Benedict the 16th, he had a motu proprio in which he wanted to spread the use of the so-called traditional Latin Mass. And in that document, he had said, he had called the so-called traditional Latin Mass the extraordinary form. So I think that reinforces the case that there's an ordinary form of the church. And today that is, you know, the so-called Novus Ordo. So I'm trying to understand the crux of the argument here, that how is it, or I would say, why would you say that the current Pope has a duty to preserve a liturgy other than the ordinary form? You answer that with Bishop Snyder, and he mentions in one of his questions, is the Pope obliged to faithfully maintain the church's liturgical rites? And the bishop brings up a document in which popes, at some point in time, I guess before the 1100s, the Pope of Rome or Bishop of Rome, he would take an oath to maintain the liturgies that he received. And that's his argument. And you mentioned that in your work, that's I think, one of the strongest arguments he makes, that the Pope used to take an oath, a profession of faith, to maintain the liturgy that he received in the traditions, in the form, in the ritual. But I found it to be a really weak argument, because at that time, it was before 1570, so the obligation or oath he would have been taking to maintain whatever liturgy would have just concerned that local Roman rite, right? It wouldn't have been some sort of ordinary form for the whole church. So I don't think it's really applicable to what's going on today. And moreover, Pope Francis does not take that, or no pope for about 1,000 years have taken that same oath. So I thought that was his strongest argument, but I found it to be rather weak. What do you say?
Sure. Well, there's several points I guess we could speak to there. With regard to the two forms language, maybe that's a place to start. It's difficult. It was made more difficult, really, by Summorum Pontificum when Benedict issued that 2007. Was, as many bishops pointed out, both at the time and, you know, continue to do so today, is that the two forms language is at best confusing, at worst misleading, just because there have never been an ordinary form of the Roman Rite, just as there's never been an extraordinary form of the Roman Rite. So some of this is a language issue, I think. The Roman Rite of Mass, which is what we're speaking of here specifically, pertains to a particular missal with its accompanying rubrics. So you have the Roman Rite being codified at Trent. There is no creation, you know, of a new rite going on at that council, which is why, of course, the missal promulgated by the Council of Trent is, you can read it next to, you know, missals that were in force 5 years prior and see this remarkable identity between the two. So the work of Trent was not a... I would avoid the two forms language. This was introduced at Summorum Pontificum, It was a complete innovation. That kind of language was never used before. So we do have uses of the Roman rites. We think of course, the use of St. Dominic is one you mentioned, the Dominican use. But this is a markedly different thing from a strictly separated ritual form. And that would take us maybe too far into the reeds, but suffice to say, when we're talking the Roman rite of Mass, we're talking a specific missal. Mm-hmm. So we have the Roman Missal. This text, it predates Trent, but Trent is, of course, responsible for codifying and also dispersing, largely by way of print. People don't get into this a whole lot, but mostly because of the print technologies at the time that make this missal spread, you know, as rapidly as it did. So when we're talking about the missal, the Roman rite, as we could call it there, the Roman rite of Mass, the idea that a new missal could be then composed, you know, and promulgated by the Pope, which is, of course, what we get in 1969, not at Vatican II, but you know, several years following, you have then the missal of Pope Paul VI, which, as you mentioned, some folks refer to as the Novus Ordo. So these two missals, I mean, it has to be said, again, by many bishops and priests since, is that referring to these as different forms of the same thing is at best confusing, especially mm-hmm. since they have, you know, a 15% overlap, right? One of them has you can look at the Roman Rite, the traditional Mass, and say 15% of what's in here. Some scholars say even less than that, but at least we could say 15%.
It depends what set of Eucharistic prayers you're using. I think Eucharistic prayer number one would probably be the closest, right? But it's still, it's not, we're talking about two different liturgies, right?
Yeah, I think that's a better framework for folks. So, so if we're talking about just two missals, then the question becomes, okay, is a missal of immemorial custom, this rite whereby, you know, Mass is offered, for the Roman rite, is this missal, is it something that falls within the purview of the Pope to authoritatively proscribe, you know, prohibit, mm-hmm. Condemn, make it such that folks cannot offer it or attend it? And this was the point that Benedict attached to Summorum Pontificum, was that this rite never was that way, was never abrogated, was never forbidden. And this was after, again, several years of a lot of bishops erroneously thinking that. And so he, you know, had to clarify with Summorum Pontificum, look, the thing has never been forbidden, abrogated, and couldn't be. And that's really his driving point, especially in the accompanying letter to bishops, is that, again, the line that gets quoted all the time is that, you know, what was sacred and great for our predecessors remains sacred and great for us too. It cannot be all of a sudden forbidden or considered harmful. And his point is just that, I get it, maybe it bears no explication, but that which is the Mass of the saints, the Mass of all our forebears, this great act of solemn worship, it actually falls within the common good of the church. So it's beyond the reach right. of a pope to prohibit such a rite.
Yeah. And but I guess going back to the question itself about, okay, let me reframe it in this form, see if I could ask it in a different way. So if Pope Francis is not, as you say, forbidding or abrogating or somehow putting a liturgy on a list of black books, you know, if he's not doing that, but if he were to just leave it in the hands of institutions, religious orders, you know, these things, Institute of Christ the King, SSPX, FSSAP, you know, some religious orders, that's just their charism. If he were to do that under the auspices of the liturgy being a discipline, not a dogma. I mean, to be sure, you know, liturgy contains magisterial aspects, dogmatic aspects, and discipline aspects. You know, for the audience, you know, I know you know this, but for some people in the audience, you know, the aspect of magisterial teachings would be those things that spring from what the church teaches, sacred scripture, the Eucharistic prayers. Dogma would be things such as the transubstantiation, the creed. Disciplines would be those things that the church says, you know, can change, you know, some traditions, even in their standing, sitting, kneeling, you know, things like that. In the church, I think in paragraph 1205 of the CCC, the church says, in the liturgy, above all that's of the sacraments, there is an immutable part, meaning it's part that cannot change. We're talking about the prayers of consecration. A part that is divinely instituted in which the church is the guardian. And she says that parts that can change, which the church has the power and occasion and also the duty to adapt to cultures of recently evangelized people. Example of that would be the Zaire use rite that's used in the Congo, formerly known as Zaire. Now, if we're talking about liturgy as a discipline, and the Pope says, religious orders, institutions, you guys keep doing it. But ordinary diocese, bishops, you can no longer celebrate the 1962 missal. Do you think that the Pope would have the authority to do that under the auspices of a discipline?
Well, who really cares what I think would be the first first response I would give to that. But at least, again, to read both Bishop Schneider's credo compendium and other bishops since the time, even at the eve of promulgating the Novus Ordo 1969, we think of the former prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, Ottaviani, and others, you know, bishops since. I would have to say no, that the Pope couldn't legitimately forbid this rite, specifically because of its patrimony. We're talking about a Roman rite priests being forbidden to say the Roman rite, which is, you know, kind of this mind-boggling. Like you say, it somehow ends up on a black book list. That at least, again, to take the teaching of these former bishops, that the rite itself, because it's an act of solemn divine worship, it rests upon apostolic and pontifical use. It bears this kind of force of immemorial custom. For that reason, if you're ordained to the Roman Rite, so priests of the Roman Rite, this would form part of their own clerical rites, that having themselves clerical rites to this form of the liturgy. So that, at least, that would be my take, as well as these other bishops.
And that sounds like that's more in line with Pope Benedict XVI was saying, that that priests should have access to the liturgy, and it shouldn't have to be some sort of thing where you got to get permission. You know, he would, I can think the argument is that that's just the patrimony. That's what you inherit as a priest. But do you find it, and this is more just, you know, your thoughts, because you're a smart guy, the liturgical wars, if Pope Francis is finding this life of the church in some places, you know, like United States, in other places, you know, it's not, you know, I travel a lot around the world. I don't encounter the liturgical wars, and I find a healthy Novus Ordo in some poorer parts of the world. Right. Because I think it comes down to culture. Some cultures are just more compatible with Catholicism, you know, and there you find a healthy Catholic church, a healthy Novus Ordo. You find big families, you find seminaries with waiting lists. In cultures that are more secular, you know, we find a liturgy, Novus Ordo, that's very much influenced by the world. We find a church that's influenced by the world. But in those places where the Pope see that it doesn't seem very healthy for there to be two liturgies, because there are some people or some groups that are using this and camping this as a way to reject Vatican II and everything else that came with it. And the Pope just finds it to be unhealthy for people, harmful for their souls, for this competition between liturgies. Why can't a Pope enforce a discipline for the good of our souls to have just one liturgy?
Sure. Again, I think it really devolves upon the extent of papal authority first. You know, obviously, we assume, of course, that the Pope is always acting for the good of souls. This is something that we polled a bunch of folks. This has been almost 3 years ago now, in regards to the Benedictus periodical, which is this monthly periodical. And we had, you know, so many thousand subscribers, and we just said, if you've been you know, harmed or feel as though the possibility of the traditional mass being restricted, if you feel that as something negative, you know, why? And so we asked kind of the same question, like, why would this strike you as something that the Pope ought not do? And I mean, we've got, you know, pages of feedback from folks, just this at will question. And, you know, many of them would raise things like, well, if there's harm to unity going on by way of the liturgy, we should look for the kind of Novus Ordos you're describing, David, right? The things with the giant puppets or the, you know, this kind of stuff that goes on. Is that, how would the form that the saints used be itself the problem? And we say, well, if the Pope sees there's these kind of fringe elements or something, and they kind of associate themselves with the mass of the ages, the mass of the saints, that's really why. Well, then it of course, you know, we're assuming acting for the good of souls, but the first question has to be, is this something that he can do, right? Is it something that he even can do prior to looking at the prudential question of whether he ought not do it, is really whether he can at all, you know, whether this is something that he has the authority to do. So to my mind, again, it's this would even be in the article I mentioned, the CCC treatment of just the compliance with just laws. You know, the CCC has a great section on the use of authority, both in the civil and the ecclesiastical sphere, so in the state as well as the church, and how we're very familiar in the U.S. of A. With laws that are not in themselves just, things that are, you know, fundamentally opposed to both our good, the good of citizens, and the good of their souls, you know, their spiritual flourishing. And so we're pretty well conversant with this section in the CCC about what things have to be in place in order for a law from a superior in the state or the church to be a morally legitimate exercise of that authority. And so, yeah. So this is really, to my mind, it's the driving question behind the TLM.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I think Pope Francis really sees this as an issue of discipline. I don't think he looks at, you know, what he may call the extraordinary form. I don't think he looks at it as, you know, somebody's inheritance. I think he just views it as a discipline. And I think there's evidence for that. Obviously, you know, we look at some of the motu proprios. That's interesting. Because I think you're coming at it probably even closer to Benedict the 16th, who would have raised it maybe above discipline, maybe above, you know, maybe just faith and morals, maybe in that category. So I think we'll definitely see what does happen, if it does happen, if the rumors are actually true. So you guys have any questions for Aaron, make sure you hop in. So as we flush his mind out in regards to what he sees the catechisms and the history of catechisms have said about this subject. Here's one for you, Aaron. Dominic says, the Last Supper is a true mass of all ages, which is not done in Latin. What do you say?
Sure. Yes, you're 100% right. I don't think there was Latin being spoken in the cenacle. That's really immaterial to the question of liturgical development. So one of the things that Christ promises to Peter, to the apostles, the Holy Spirit will lead you into all truth, that the greater things than these shall ye do. This is part of the work of the church. There were no canons or dogmatic decrees issued in about that time either. So what we have with the liturgy is this progression of insight into the divine mysteries, that takes the form of this organic development over centuries. This is part of what the Holy Spirit does through the apparatus of sacred tradition. It's why we have all of this very strong language. David, you mentioned the medieval papal oath, which actually was enforced until relatively recently. It wasn't strictly a medieval phenomenon. But this sense of the rites themselves being a context for divine revelation, we have a much stronger sense that the rites, how that is to say the ceremonies, so not just, oh, the Eucharist is made present, right? An evil priest at a black mass can do that. Okay, so we're talking about a ritual form that is itself a means of divine self-disclosure in and through the very form that the Holy Spirit has developed in the life of the church. We think about the kind of work that God does in the Old Testament, the very minute detail that he levies around. Gosh, a good read through the book of Leviticus will help anybody needing a refresher there. This incredibly exacting detail about, you know, the priest will move here, he will wear this, he will use this incense, then this instrument will be used as he turns to here. The reason that God is so interested in this, in the work of divine worship, is that he's using it as a vehicle to disclose himself. There are divine mysteries that can only be revealed by way of this symbolic language, just as it's only by that language that we can fully offer ourselves back to God. So yes, Last Supper, not in Latin, it's immaterial to what the Mass is. We have this progress within the life of the church, and it's precisely by the apparatus of sacred tradition that we get what we get in the Mass.
Yeah. Catholic Chris Thero, he asks, will anything change until the clergy starts preaching the hard truth from the pulpit? The USCC sure won't. So I think John is, I wonder how this relates to what we're talking about. But yeah, take your stab, Aaron. I think this is just a broader question. Like, will anything change until, clergy starts preaching the truth?
We could definitely benefit from clergy speak of the truth. I think the legacy of Catholic history certainly shows us that lesson, you know, time and again, that we have in some periods only one, you know, champion professor of the faith amongst the clergy. And I'm thinking specifically of the episcopate of the bishops. You know, it's easy for us today to kind of clap and say, you know, yay, St. Athanasius, yay, St. Basil. You know, you get this handful. I mean, you're talking about a half dozen in the world of bishops who are carrying the torch of the immutable Catholic doctrine, Catholic morals, Catholic worship, at a time when they're being persecuted, not only from heretics outside, from the civil power outside, but even from within, right? Let us not forget, St. Athanasius is exiled by the Pope, you know, several times. So it's easy for us 20 centuries hence, 15 centuries hence, to be looking at these periods with relative comfort. But we need to remember, living on the ground in times like that would have been just as disorienting as today. And it absolutely, the cure is the same, that we need saints. We need specifically saints who are bishops to do their job. Absolutely.
Yeah, I heard that argument before about the Black Mass thing. Are people saying that Christ will come, like if you say the prayers of consecration at a Black Mass, that the Holy Eucharist will be Christ? Is that what the argument is?
Well, specifically if a priest does it, a validly ordained priest. Yeah.
That even though that's not the form of the liturgy and a priest is not intending to do what the church intends to do, that will still be a valid consecration?
Well, the argument is that especially for us Westerners who are legal positivists, you know, if we're anything, we're very Western in that mindset, is that all of our definitions, dogmatically speaking, in terms of the sacraments, are, you know, valid minister, proper intention, matter and form. And sadly, you know, we have many years of examples of validly ordained priests who go off the rails, and some of which who do they they use the proper formula. They have the intention to bring about, you know, the presence of Christ in the sacrament, and they do it in these heinous, you know, evil kind of situations. So it's a dreadful. I mean, by extension, we could point to, oh gosh, there was just one in India not long ago. They had a Krishna mass, right, where they processed around with an idol of one of the local Hindu deities, and then proceeded to have mass. And so, well, okay, so this is kind of a reductio ad absurdum here, but if we're saying that you've got matter, form, intention, valid minister, says the words, does the thing. Of course, it's a grave sacrilege. You know, it's a heinous sin of sacrilege. But that's why the question of the ritual form is a related but separate consideration from whether or not a valid Eucharist is present.
I just think that's a very Western idea to look at a liturgy. I don't know if the Eastern would consider, because liturgy is more of a whole than these pieces and parts, right? Eastern liturgy Catholics, they wouldn't even say, we have a history with, Aquinas and that scholastic period, saying there's a particular point in time when Christ comes to be, right? I wouldn't. Just so many theological issues with that. Just the immutable part of the Mass, which is the prayers of consecration. The Holy Eucharist itself is preternatural to the Mass. That's where it comes to be. It's a whole thing. So I hear that argument. I just don't think it's completely well thought out. It's a great legal argument, like you said, on words, but I think it doesn't take the holistic view of the liturgy, which I think you, from what you said, I think you understand the holistic view of the liturgy, that it's a whole thing. From the beginning to the end, it's part of salvation history. It's timeless. I mean, when we step into the Mass, we go back in time several times during the reading of the word, during the processions. It's a liturgy is type of a state. Liturgy itself, I think we think of a what, but liturgy can be thought of as of a who that we're encountering. So the Black Mass thing, I think, is just rather weak. I don't know.
I'm so glad you think that way, because it's a tremendous moral consideration for folks, which I think often gets kind of overlooked. You hear this kind of language all the time. Well, as long as the consecration's there, then it's Mass. But then it totally presses the question of, okay, well, if we have a Pachamama Mass, if we have a Krishna Mass, yeah. Where is that, if we've got tambourines and ribbon dancers that, that the hippies just can't let it go at St. Crazy's down the street. Who's to say that that's irreverent? Who's to say that that has any kind of moral problems connected with it, if it's still got Catholic on the door and a valid consecration going on during it? So yeah. I agree.
I hear the argument. I think recently I heard it from Father Murr, some other places. As long as the priest says, this is my body, this is my blood, it's Mass, right? Such a low standard. But I know that teaching has some history within the church, but man, such a low standard. If that's the case, I went to Mass in Spain not that long ago. Aaron, I didn't know what the heck was going on. I didn't know. I've seen the Novus Ordo over here done things out of order, right? Things sort of plucked out, maybe a reading. But what I saw there was just like, where am I at? But he sure did say the prayers of consecration. And so I'm not receiving Holy Eucharist there, because I don't know if this is a valid. I don't even know what's going on. So I think it's just such a very low standard.
I agree. I think there's two questions. One is the validity of the sacrament. Does a sacrament happen? The other question, and in many ways, at least for Catholics, for all of prior history, the way we thought about it was that that's kind of immaterial, like whether or not the validity of the Eucharist is occurring. I mean, of course, it's important, but when we're looking at Mass, we're looking at a broader moral question. It's the question of worship. What is right worship? What is proper reverence? That's a bigger question than whether or not the sacrament's there.
Yeah. Right. Because that's what we're obligated to attend to, the holy obligation, not to receive Holy Communion. So yes, what does God do? I find those arguments to be interesting. I do. And I think, it's interesting. You look at the Carolingian rites, you know, with the Carolingian kings and Charlemagne and Pepin and Sherwood, what they did when they brought the Roman rites into Germany, into their territories, you know, is even they thought over the 200 years they were working at, maybe 300, they kept reforming it. The Roman rites, which, you know, from 1570 on, they kept, you know, tweaking things here and there. What I find most disappointing about the Novus Ordo, the ordinary form now, is that at least this Pope just doesn't have any interest in fixing what needs to be fixed. And I find the fixes to be rather simple, you know, and it's not a matter of trying to make it like the 1962. I don't think that is a fair thing to try to do. Let that liturgy be. But if you're going to have a new liturgy, there's some things that you have to be interested in reforming it. It's a very young liturgy. We're talking about, 50, 60 years. It's very young. But you have to be interested in reforming it and not just settle for what we have. And so I think Pope Francis spends far too much time and attention on the 1962 Missal and these issues that he's facing from some sets, especially in North America, than doing what he needs to do to reform the liturgy. We had a whole mass nightmare series on this channel for like 2 years. And we've seen just the most horrendous things. And I just think more due attention needs to be made to reform this liturgy to somehow bring about, as you say, worship that is that God is due as God. What do you think about the lack of reform of this liturgy for the past 60 years?
Well, much as I love your content, David, I got to say I'm glad I missed the Mass Nightmares series. This sounds awful.
I try to make it as funny as I can, as I could. You know, we would have like a Father Flager Mass over here, and then we would have the only thing you could judge a Novus Ordo Mass by is by the Missal, right? So we would have the Missal up over here, and we would just go down and say, this is what he said. This is what he was supposed to say. And then we'll laugh along the way, because these things, either you laughed or you cried, Aaron. That was it.
Yeah, I'm with you. You have to laugh or you would cry. It. I'm not sure what to make of the Pope's kind of lack of concern, I would say, about the obvious and widespread liturgical deviations. I mean, this is something that the bishops informed the Holy Office about years ago when he sent that request for feedback from the bishops of the world with regard to the situation of the liturgy in their dioceses, and many of them, you know, went, that was like a closed data set, but then many of them who had written in about it later spoke about, you know, released either what they had sent in or had spoke about it within their own dioceses. And that was a common point of observation, was that that many of them saying, look, we need some way in which we can both be educating well about the faith as it's enacted at Mass. You know, the Mass is just dogma in motion, right? And then also the presence of these liturgical abuses that folks want to rein in from place to place, time to time. I mean, every diocese. And of course, talking about the catechesis side of things, I mean, nowhere is that made clearer than in the U.S. of A., when we have all of these Pew studies and whatnot about belief in the true presence. I mean, when you're talking about less than 30%, I think was a number I saw somewhere, of self-describing Catholics.
There's been a few different polls. It's interesting because one poll recently, I think last year, said 50%. I think another one is getting higher. I don't know what to make of that. Maybe they're like political polls. It depends who's polling, who's asking the question. Yeah. But the problem is that it's not 100%, right?
Right. Yeah, that should be a difficult data point to not get, you know.
It should be like, are you breathing? Yes.
Yes. If you are responding to this questionnaire, check. Yes. Yeah, it really strikes me as peculiar. Although I've also seen folks make this point, which I'm inclined to agree with too, is that the part of the challenge specific to the Novus Ordo is its kind of inherent malleability. You know, that you have
exactly.
You know, it's really, it has so much kind of choose your own adventure built into not only the missile itself, but also the rubrics that accompany it.
Yeah.
That you can get.
Yeah, that definitely has to be the first reform. You definitely have to go down, I think, to just, if you need multiple Eucharistic prayers, no more than two. And I don't know why you would have more than two, but more than one, but too many options and too many places where the priest can insert his ego. And it's harmful for the priest, even just to be facing the people. It's just harmful for him to, over time, he just views himself as an entertainer. It's harmful for his soul. So, it's too malleable. And it's just set up as a form of entertainment over time.
I'll tell you, I just a week or so ago, I was in conversation with an archbishop in India. And the Excellency was talking about this problem they have there, which is a problem of the malleability in the Mass, but specifically the language issue. And I couldn't help, but kind of smile. And of course, I gave what you might expect a response to this, but His Excellency was saying about how, we just have this problem because in India, there's millions and millions of people, even in a given diocese, from time to time. And there's 30 different languages that are spoken. I mean, you're talking about things that we don't have to deal with here. In the States, about even sub-dialects, so much, although, of course, our Southern brethren might take offense at this. But, we've got English, we've got American English, right? There's a English English, American English, and then there's like Southern American English, right? But in India, you're talking about separate dialects in the dozens in terms of the languages. And so, what's a priest to do when you get this kind of fill in the blank missile, and then the question of language? And so the Archbishop was kind of sharing some of these struggles that they have there, And I just couldn't help but say, Excellency, have you ever considered the traditional Mass? Yeah. You got one language, Catholics used to know it. I mean, we talk about a vehicle for unity, right?
That's a good point. And I think I'm going to let you go on that, Aaron. I'm going to have you back, sometime maybe after what happens, the rumors, if they happen. Definitely got to have you back, get your thoughts on that. But I have to end it on you calling it the fill in the blank. A missile. That's just a good place. I've never heard it called filling the blank missile. But
well, yeah, I'm gonna take credit for that then, if you like.
That's pretty good. Well, thanks for coming on Off Code Unscripted. Really appreciate your time. Everyone, please hop over to TradiVox. That's TradiVox.com. Check out what Aaron is doing there. If you like it, support him. And I'll keep him and your family in your prayers. Thanks again, Aaron.
Thank you, David. God bless y'all.
Yep. And for everyone watching, thanks for watching. And I'll be back, I think, next week, unless something crazy happens, like Instrumentum Laboris somehow appears on Friday. I'm not giving away anything, but if it does appear on Friday, I'll be back to maybe comment on that. But have a blessed 4th of July. We'll be celebrating here as well on Ramstein Air Force Base. Lots of fireworks here. So we'll do it earlier than you will. But celebrate our independence. And I will see you next time. Blessings and shalom to you and to you.